Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Veterinary Technician Specialist in Anesthesia and Analgesia, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. Hello and welcome to everyone to this webinar on pain management. Pain is a really complex phenomenon involving many different processes, and we've all got different ideas and perceptions of pain. So it's not unrealistic to assume that animals don't have similar feelings as we do about it. And we see varying pain thresholds in our patients, ranging from the stoic staffy to the wimpy whippet. And I've seen huge changes in the way that we view animal pain since I started out in veterinary nursing many years ago now, from the naive idea back in the early day that animals don't feel pain and therefore weren't given any analgesia for routine surgeries, to the way in which pain is treated in animals today. So this is a really big topic to cover in a short time, and I've decided to divide the talk into three sections. So we're going to look at the pathophysiology of pain, how we can assess different types of pain, and the various ways in which pain can be treated. I just want to clear up a little bit of maybe confusion over the terminology of nociception and pain. So nociception is literally pain perception, that's what it means, but we talk of pain being perceived in the conscious animal. So nociception is the physiological process of transmitting information. So it's the input to the brain from the tissues, whereas pain is a sensation. It's the output from the brain. In other words, it's response or the experience. And you can get nociception without pain, and you can get pain without nociception. So although the terms are used interchangeably, there is a difference. There are many ways of classifying pain. It can be acute or chronic, which are now called adaptive and maladaptive. So adaptive pain is a normal response to tissue damage, and it's a warning of damage in order to aid healing. So, for example, post-operative pain, injury, and inflammation. And there is a gene mutation that's seen in people that results in something called congenital analgesia or congenital insensitivity to pain, and that can be the cause of unintentional self-inflicted injuries or even death. And we see this in people. There's a village in Sweden with a high number of people with this genetic disorder, and it's also seen in the United States of America and also in some tribes of Africa. So although it sounds good if you don't feel pain, it isn't good because obviously we can hurt ourselves without realizing it. And then we've got maladaptive pain, which is due to rewiring in the brain. So acute pain is caused by injury, and it's now called adaptive pain. And chronic pain persists beyond the normal expected time because the brain still perceives a threat when actually there is none. And chronic pain occurs because of damage to the peripheral or the central nervous system, or due to incorrect processing of pain, leading to hypersensitivity. And it's considered a disease state and it serves no biological purpose. The WSAVA Pain Council suggests that chronic pain is pain that lasts for more than 3 months. And then other pain classifications are nociceptive, neuropathic, and inflammatory. The nociceptive pain is where the injury stimulates nociceptors or pain receptors and signals are sent to the spinal cord and the brain. Neuropathic pain is where there's something in the central or peripheral nervous system with increased sensitivity to pain, and that's called hyperalgesia, and we'll look at that in a moment, or pain from a stimulus that doesn't normally cause pain, and that's called allodynia. Phantom limb pain is due to damage of peripheral nerves and rewiring of nerves in the brain and spinal cord. And then inflammatory pain is pain in the presence of inflammation. So an example of that would be acute post-operative pain. And the duration and intensity is proportional to the severity and duration of the tissue damage. And then still more ways to classify pain. Somatic is to do with the skin, muscle, or the soft tissue, and it can be superficial or deep. And visceral is the organs. And we've got different types of nerve fibers that carry pain signals, which we'll look at next. So there are two types of sensory nerve cells that transmit signals from peripheral tissues to the spinal cord and the brain. The A delta and the C fibers are sensory nerve fibers that carry signals from the periphery to the central nervous system. And the A delta are myelinated fibers. That just means that they're covered in a myelin sheath, and they conduct signals more quickly because of the myelin. And they're responsible for the first pain in an injury, and that's the sharp physiological pain. And the C fibers are unmyelinated, so they're not covered in any myelin sheath, and therefore they carry the signals slowly, and they're responsible for pathological pain. And then a couple of other terms that you hear about is central sensitization and wind up. Central sensitization is where normal inputs result in an abnormally high reactive state, and the pain threshold is lowered, the pain signals are amplified, and the end product is what we call wind up, or its proper term is central neuronal hypersensitization. And pain is perceived in unrelated areas, as in referred pain and phantom limb pain. Acute pain is made worse and it results in maladaptive pain. And in people, interestingly, it also leads to heightened sensitivities of all the senses. So that's light, sound, and smell. So you know when you have a headache, you can't bear light, which may not be bright, it might just be normal light, but light is very, we get very sensitive to light. We also don't like loud noises if we have a headache, and also smell. So smells, in fact, in people can lead to headaches. And it's associated in people again with poor concentration, short-term memory loss, and anxiety. And so certainly we see patients which have chronic pain and that do end up with wind up also are very anxious. And hyperalgesia is an exaggerated pain response from a normally painful stimulus, whereas allodynia, which literally means other pain, is pain from a stimulus that is not normally painful, and this is a component of maladaptive pain. So an example of this in people would be when you sit in the sun, when it ever is sunny in the UK, and you get sunburn, and then you go and put your shirt on, and you're expecting your shoulders to hurt or something. Or if you have again back to the headaches, if you have a headache, sometimes just wearing glasses, if you have a headache, means that we have increased sensitivity because of the pressure on the bridge of the nose, or some people that have headaches can't wear hats, for example. So those are examples of allodynia. And A beta fibers are not pain related, but they carry information on touch. And the gait control theory is important when considering things like massage, or when rubbing a painful area, or after banging your funny bone, that ulnar nerve, which they call the funny bone, and it's never funny, is it? So the gait control theory is a theory that proposes that we have gates in the ascending pain pathway, and these gates can be either open or closed, and that will determine whether the pain signal can pass through the gate if it's open, or if they are blocked at the gate if it's closed. And so when you rub or put pressure on an area, you activate the A beta fibers and you close that gate in the ascending pain pathway, so the signal can't be transmitted on to the brain. So I've just tried to do a diagrammatical, simple representation of this. So if you look at the top diagram, if I can just grab my pointer, oops. So up here we've got the gate which is open. So here's the gate and it's open. So we've got the A beta fibers mean that here we've got pain can be transmitted through this open gate, and it can go on up to the spinal cord and the brain. Whereas down here we've got the gate is closed. So activating those A beta fibers somehow, bit of massage or physiotherapy or rubbing or something, closes this gate here. And so the C fiber that's carrying the pain signal cannot be transmitted. It's blocked. It can't get through that gate. And so this theory was first proposed by two people called Melzack and Wall right back in 1965. And it still is very much respected in today's human and veterinary medicine. There are four stages of the physiological processes of pain. So we have transduction, and that's where information is converted into an electrical form. And then we've got transmission, which is when signals are carried by the A delta and C fibers to the spinal cord and the brain. In modulation, the signals are either enhanced or they're inhibited. And then in the conscious animal, pain is perceived if the signals reach the brain. So again, a fairly simplistic pictorial view of a dog. This is my old Bear treading on a nail. So down here, this black thing here is supposed to be the nail. So this is kind of what happens when something painful occurs. So first of all, we have the transduction. So sensory nerve endings and nociceptors detect the damage, and an electrical impulse is initiated. And then up here, along here, we have transmission. So the sensory nerves, that's the A delta and the C fibers, carry the signals to the spinal cord. Modulation occurs here, so the signals are either enhanced by the excitatory neurotransmitters or they're inhibited by the inhibitory neurotransmitters. And if the pain signals carry on, then pain is perceived in the cerebral cortex of the conscious animal, and this is perception. So NMDA, this NMDA stands for N-methyl-D-aspartate, and it's an amino acid derivative, and it's similar to glutamate, which is one of the excitatory neurotransmitters. And NMDA is involved with pain. Activation of receptors increases the pain response, and it can lead to wind up and central sensitization in neuropathic pain. NMDA is also involved with learning, memory, and depression in people, and overstimulation in people leads to Huntington's disease and also adds to defects that occur in Alzheimer's disease. So NMDA antagonist drugs are very good analgesics, and the ones that we use, well, ketamine is the classic, but methadone has also got NMDA properties. Okay, so now we're going to move on to section two, which is assessment of pain. There are many ways of assessing pain. So we've got things here, observing the patient, so just looking at the patient and seeing if you think it's in pain, palpation of potentially painful areas or areas that you know are actually painful, any changes in behavior. Appetite changes tend to be that they stop eating, but it might be that if you're assessing pain and the pain is diminishing, then the appetite returns. We've got quite a few classic postural changes. And then physiological parameters, yes, although functionality, so whether an animal uses its leg or uses the part of it that's supposed to be painful, is a better indicator for chronic pain rather than your physiological parameters. So that's things like your temperature, pulse, respiration, and blood pressure, because it's now questionable as to the validity and usefulness of your physiological parameters, because they can change because of other things, typically stress, but maybe not necessarily pain. And then pain scales. These have really come to the fore in the last, I don't know, 10 years maybe or so of veterinary medicine. So we're going to look at some of the pain scales that are in use today. So just starting off with whether a pain scale has been validated. So validation of a pain scale just means that the same results are obtained when the scale is used by different people all over the world. And pain scales are validated for specific species, specific diseases or conditions. So, for example, one might be validated for cats only, or one might be validated for osteoarthritis in the hind limb of a dog only. So they are actually quite specific. The unidimensional pain scales were amongst the first to be designed originally in the veterinary sector, and they were originally for acute pain only. And they only consider the intensity of pain, whereas the multidimensional scales that we've got nowadays consider the sensory and the affective qualities of pain. In other words, pain affects the quality of life. And all of them are subjective. So what one person thinks, another person might disagree with, and none of these are reliable or validated. So we've got the simple descriptive scale, and this has got several descriptors, such as no pain to very severe pain. It's simple, as its name implies, and it's easy to use, but it is very subjective. The numerical rating scale is quite similar to the simple descriptive scale, but each descriptor has a number, and the scale goes from 0 to 10. But the numbers aren't numerically related, so 4 would not mean something is twice as painful as 2. And then the visual analog scale consists of a line that's 100 millimeters long, but there aren't any numbers on that line. And a cross is placed on the line at the level of pain, and then a numerical value is assigned. So you can see that these three are all very open to interpretation. So there are many multidimensional scales nowadays, and many of them have got interventional scores. So when you get to a certain number, analgesia is recommended. So the Glasgow Composite Measure Pain Scale, short form for dogs and cats, is validated. And the canine scale has got 30 descriptors in 6 behavioural categories, including mobility, which may or may not be able to be assessed, depending on whether the animal's mobile or not. And numerical ranking is assigned. The maximum score is 24. Or if you can't assess mobility, then the maximum score is 20. And the recommended intervention level for analgesia is either 6 out of 24 or 5 out of 20. There are 28 descriptors for the feline version for cats in 7 behavioural categories. The maximum score is 20, and the recommended intervention level is 5 out of 20. And the Botucatu scale is validated for post-operative pain in cats, but after ovarian hysterectomy, so cat spayed. And the Colorado scales, they're not validated, but they are very easy to use, and they are available for dogs and cats. So this is the feline version of the Colorado State University acute pain scale. So we tick the boxes for psychological and behavioral signs, and also response to palpation. And then body tension, which is over here on the right, this bit here, body tension, you can see here you've got something which is really the simple descriptive method that's used to assess that. And then we look at the pictures of the cat, especially the facial expression, and that helps us to assess the demeanour. And so when you've done all of this, you see how and where your tics are distributed, and you gauge really a pain score, which is 0 to 4. But if you look down here, you can see that it can include increments of 0.25, 0.5, and 0.75. So we've got sort of quarterly increments. And the pain analgesia plan is reviewed if the score is equal to or more than 2. But you can see that there is actually quite a bit of crossover there between the various different categories. So you can have, matches with the category below. Looking at the facial expressions has sort of been a bit of a precursor to the FACES pain or grimace scale that we use now in veterinary medicine. This is taken from the Wong Baker FACES scale for children, which has been used in human medicine for quite a long time. So we have also the grimace scale, which was first devised for laboratory animals, and that's now used for cats, rabbits, rats, mice, and horses. And then other multidimensional pain scales that are in use now include these that I've listed here. So LODE is the Liverpool Osteoarthritis in Dogs, and that one was originally devised for canine elbow arthritis. The owner answers a set of questions which relate to the previous 7 days. And there's no rating as such, but the questions are mostly specific. So they include things like what sort of terrain the dog is exercised on. So is it, level? Is it steep or bumpy? Whether the dog is on or off the lead, and so on. Some of the questions can be a bit subjective because the responses are very moderate or mild. But mostly the owner just does it according to very specific questions. The canine brief pain inventory is also a set of questions, also based over the previous 7 days. The last question is an overall impression for the quality of life over the last 7 days. And the Helsinki Chronic Pain Index is very similar to the canine brief pain inventory in that there are questions, but the rating value is lower and it's not based over previous 7 days. Now, all of these have been validated for chronic osteoarthritis pain, and the owners score them at home. There are others which have been validated, but they haven't all been translated into English. The Helsinki one was translated from Finnish to English, and that means that we can use it. And there are others that exist that are good, but unless you can speak Japanese, for example, there is a very good Japanese one. At the moment, we can't use those. So coming up next is a series of photos of dogs, cats, and I've got a couple of rabbits just to see if we can assess pain visually. So it's just a little exercise, which I'm just going to give you a minute or two to have a think about. So looking at these two cats, what would you say about the level of pain in each of these cats? So we've got a little Turkish van cat on the left and a little black cat on the right. So obviously you don't know these cats or the history behind them, but just looking at their facial expressions. So the Turkish van cat here is actually spaced out on methadone. So he's not in pain. He's actually very happy, but he is a little bit away with the fairies at the moment. But if you look at the black cat over here, she does look miserable. She's sort of got a fairly dull face. Her back leg here is stretched out, so maybe she's got tummy ache, and the paw is splayed. So this cat looks miserable. So here we've got a Sphinx cat. Actually, really difficult to judge whether these cats are in pain or not because often they don't change their posture and they're always sort of slightly hunched. But what would you think about? Obviously, it's the same cat. So on the left, he does look a bit glum. You can see he's sort of got a hunchback, but that's the nature of the cat anyway. We weren't sure about this cat, so he was given some analgesia. And then you can see on the right, we've got a much happier cat. He's sitting up. His facial expression is brighter. He's looking at us, and he just looks happier. Okay, so this slide and the next one, and I'm going to flick between them, shows a couple of different greyhounds. So although they're both black greyhounds, it isn't actually the same dog. So I'm just going to go back with, onto the next slide, sorry, and back to this slide, and just see if you think if either of these greyhounds is in pain, is either in pain or in both in pain. You can't see terribly well this one because it's black and it's quite a dark photo, but he's down on his front legs. Then his back goes up here, his tail's up there, so he's sort of classically front legs down, bottom up in the air. So we've got that one there, and then we've got this greyhound here. So it is a different one. That one in pain. Yes, no. That one in pain. Difficult to tell, but this greyhound here, could well be showing signs of abdominal pain because he's doing the classic prayer position, but actually, this dog is just stretching and he's not praying. This dog is in pain. This dog is wide-eyed and he's biting the bars. This poor chap came in with severe neck pain, and this photo was taken straight after admission before analgesia was given. He was also very, very vocal, as you would expect a greyhound to be. So we can tell here, and if you look at the whites of his eyes and the fact that he's kind of just hung his top jaw on the top bar on the bar, and he can't really be bothered to move it. So yeah, he is in pain. For rabbits, the Grimace scale is used, and that looks at changes in facial expression. So we've got flattening of the cheeks, the shape of the nose, tightening of the eyes, and then also the position of the whiskers and the position of the ears. And ideally, when you're using the rabbit grimace scale, you observe the rabbit from a distance so that actually having a predator approach the animal doesn't change its behavior. So here we're just looking at the eyes. So if you look at the rabbit over here on the left, he's got open, what we call normal eyes. So this rabbit's not in pain. And then the rabbit in the middle, his eyes are closing. And then over here, we've got completely closed eyes, and so this rabbit here could well be in pain. And then moving on to just looking at the rabbit's ears, that can indicate whether or not they're in pain. So over here again, starting from the left, we've got ears which are upright, probably no pain. And then in varying degrees of pain, they start to get flatter and flatter against the head. And that together with other signs can indicate pain. So to treat or not to treat, that is the question. Well, if there's any doubt as to whether an animal is in pain or not, a test dose of analgesia should be given, so an analgesic drug should be given, and then the patient is reassessed to see if it's responded or not. And analgesia should never be withheld because somebody doesn't want to keep the patient, somebody wants to keep the patient still, which is something that used to happen, I'm afraid to say, many, many years ago, or because it's thought that analgesia will mask any signs, that this is unethical. And if we think or suspect that an animal is in pain, then it should be given or it must be given analgesia. And another myth to dispel is very young patients do feel pain. Historically, many, many years ago, it was thought that young and small animals didn't feel pain, and now we know that's ridiculous. We know better nowadays. And when considering analgesia, we mustn't forget nursing care and TLC, because this improves morale and well-being and decreases stress, and decreased stress means that there's decreased pain. So now we move on to treatment options. So what treatment is used depends on the reason for needing analgesia and the type of pain. And not all individuals are going to respond in the same way. So we've got a dog on the left here that's got ocular pain. This little chap is squinting. It's normal light in the wards, but for him, it's bright lights. And so this type of pain is making this dog miserable. And then over here, we've got the most horrendous injury. This is obviously a very, very extensive open wound. This is actually a groin injury, not groin Not groin as in, ironically, it's near its groin. Not groin as in the anatomy, but from a beach groin, the sort of concrete things that they put on the beach. So this dog was jumping over the groins and got impaled on one. And as you can see, it's the most horrific injury. So we're expecting a lot of pain. And some conditions that we see in our patients, and we need to treat, are multifactorial. There are many different things which contribute towards the pain, and a classic example of that would be osteoarthritis. And for those, several different combined treatment modalities are needed. So I'm going to start off by looking at drugs, because obviously drugs are the mainstay of our analgesia. And we've got many different drugs that are used, and many of them, just remember that I've mentioned here in the webinar, are off license, and they would need to be prescribed according to the cascade. So we've got opioids. These act at opioid receptor sites, which are primarily in the brain and spinal cord. And we've got the pure and the partial opioids, and then we've got the mixed agonist-antagonist opioid. So the pure opioids that are commonly used are morphine, methadone, and fentanyl. I think pethidine probably isn't used so much nowadays because of its short duration of action. It doesn't last very long at all. The partial opioid agonist in small animal use is buprenorphine, and then the mixed agonist antagonist is butorphanol, although butorphanol is really only useful for sedation, not analgesia, or it would be analgesia for very mild pain. And then we've got oral preparations of codeine and tramadol. Tramadol is a synthetic analogue of codeine and is thought to reduce the release of substance P. Substance P is a neurotransmitter that's associated with pain and inflammation. However, tramadol is questionable now as to how effective it actually is. And then the opioid antagonist, so if we don't like what the opioid has done, we can reverse it with naloxone. And we've got non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. These act by inhibiting the action of cyclooxygenase enzymes, or COX enzymes, and these control the function of prostaglandins. Prostaglandins are compounds that bring about a wide range of physiological processes, such as the regulation of blood pressure, bone marrow functioning, and then also they're responsible for pain and inflammation. There are actually three groups. I've only got two here because we're mostly concerned with two, but we've got COX-1, COX-2, and COX-3. COX-1 forms the prostaglandins for renal perfusion, protection of the gastric mucosa, and bone marrow functioning. So that's the sort of good physiological functions. And COX-2 enzymes forms the prostaglandins for pain and inflammation. So they're the bad guys, if you like. And a good non-steroidal should be COX-2 selective. In other words, it should abolish pain and inflammation but preserve the COX-1 functions. However, it is known now that COX-2 does also have some normal homeostatic functions that we don't want to abolish. But the side effects, or the undesirable effects, of non-steroidals are, as we know, renal damage, gastric irritation, and then the bone marrow and blood dyscrasias. Most of the non-steroidals, in fact, nearly all of them, act peripherally. Carprofen is a centrally acting one, and they're useful for musculoskeletal conditions. But they can also be used in combination with opioids to provide multimodal analgesia, as in perioperative use. So these are the ones that are commonly used in the veterinary field. So we've got meloxicam, carprofen, thiacloxib, which is Previcox, rebenacoxib, which is Onsior, and maybe, don't know, some people might use mavacoxib, which is Trococcil. But in 2013, the World Health Organization defined a new class of drug called the prostaglandin receptor antagonist, or the piperant class. So this is a non-COX inhibiting class of drugs that only block the prostaglandin receptor for pain and inflammation, and that's the EP4 receptor. And the drug that we use in the veterinary field is Grapiprant, which is marketed as Galliprant, and it's only been available since the beginning of this year being 2019. And it's in tablet form, and it is for osteoarthritis pain in dogs. And then others that we've got, acetaminophen is paracetamol, is a COX-3 inhibitor actually. It's not classed as a non-steroidal drug because of its very weak anti-inflammatory properties. It's used in dogs only, not in cats. They're not able to metabolize it, and if we gave it to cats, it would cause liver toxicity and liver failure. So it's for dogs only. In tablet form, it's a single strength, which is 500 milligrams. It's the same as the paracetamol that we buy in the chemist. You can get it in injectable form for IV injection. It's marketed as Pafalgan, and this is 10 milligrams per mil, and it's given intravenously. There is an oral liquid, which is for children, so it is for humans only, but there isn't anything to stop anyone going and buying it. So you can get an oral liquid at the pharmacy in different strengths. So it comes as 24 milligrams per mil, 50 mgs per mil. So it is easier to dose smaller dogs. However, that is definitely off license. Veterinary surgeons can't advise you to do that, and it would be within the prescribing cascade if it were ever advised. And then the NMDA receptor antagonist that I touched on earlier. So commonly we've got ketamine, and then we've got others, amantadine and memantine, which is quite similar. And as I said, methadone has also got NMDA properties. So ketamine is very good for neuropathic, bone, and phantom limb pain. And then amantadine and memantine are for osteoarthritis and cancer pain. And the alpha-2 adrenergic agonists, these agents stimulate receptors in the spinal cord, leading to the inhibition of substances that are responsible for transmitting nociceptive signals. They have synergistic actions with opioids, because the alpha-2s and the opioids occupy very similar sites in the brain. They can be given by constant rate infusion. Also, you can give them via the intra-articular or extradural route. And the antagonist, so the reversal agent, is atipamezole. Atipamezole is given intramuscularly, but you can give it intravenously in an emergency situation. Again, it's not licensed by that route. And then we've got gabapentin, which is an anti-epileptic, anti-convulsant drug that has got anti-nociceptive effects, and it's mainly used for treating neuropathic pain. And one which you may or may not have come across is zoledronic acid. Zoledronic acid is what's called a bisphosphonate, so it modulates the effects on osteoblasts or bone cells of macrophages, which are responsible for bone resorption. So these agents, bisphosphonates, decrease bone resorption and increase the lifespan of osteocytes, which are ma the mature bone cells. This is useful for veterinary patients. It's given by IV infusion. It's very good for bone pain, particularly bone cancers. And local anesthetic agents prevent the transmission of pain signals. And there are many methods and many ways of using them. They can be used on their own for nerve blocks, or diluted and infiltrated down a wound diffusion catheter or down a chest tube, and they're used for epidural, or we can use microdoses for constant rate infusion. So these are some of the local anesthetic agents that we commonly use in our small animal veterinary patients. So starting up here on the left, this is bupivacaine, which is marketed as at the moment as Marcaine. And then over here we've got ropivacaine, which is Narapin. It's very similar to bupivacaine, it's more expensive, and it has fewer cardiovascular effects. And then over here we've got good old Emla cream. And then we've got lidocaine. Here we've got lidocaine, which is being used as a CRI. So if you're using lidocaine intravenously, you must make sure it's the preparation without adrenaline. And then here we've got lidocaine, 2%. So 2%, remember, is 20 milligrams per mil. Here we've got a wound diffusion catheter in a collie after we've amputated the front leg. So the front leg's taken up really, really high at the shoulder, and this collie's got a wound diffusion catheter placed at the time of surgery, and together with local anaesthetic and opioid and a ketamine CRI, this dog was very, very comfortable. And then here, slightly unusually, we've actually got an epidural catheter. So we can put preservative-free morphine in the epidural space, and that's very good because it travels cranially and it lasts for 24 hours. So that's really good for abdominal pain. And obviously, you can put local anaesthetic, which travels cranially. So it's not usual to actually have a catheter in place, but if you have something that's having surgery, so maybe an XLAP, or and it's maybe the animal's got pancreatitis, then it's very, very good for abdominal pain. And then we mustn't forget the non-drug methods. So we've got all of these methods here, and I'm just going to look at each one in turn because obviously all of these add to pain relief. So I'm going to start off with some of the physiotherapy techniques. So thermotherapy is the application of heat, and it increases blood flow to the area, and this aids healing. And again, it provides analgesia, and this is used when inflammation has subsided. So this little Daxie, which has got backache, is very happy with just a normal wheat bag, a warmish wheat bag, not too hot, obviously, shaken well, so you haven't got any hot spots placed over her back, and it did mean that she was able to go to sleep. Cryotherapy is the opposite. It's the application of cold, and this will help reduce inflammation and therefore pain. And it's especially useful after orthopedic procedures such as cruciate surgery. So, in the photo on the left here, we're just doing some cold manual compression. And this here, the photo on the right, this is a cryo cuff and a cryo unit. So, this is a cuff. You fill the unit is filled with cold water and ice, and then you attach the unit to the cuff with this hose here, and then you fill the cuff with ice cold water, and that therefore is applied and left in place for 10-15 minutes. It's a human appliance, but very useful for veterinary patients as well. So before performing any physiotherapy techniques, we need to make sure the muscles are warmed up first. Various exercises that we can do, some are passive and others are active. So we've got things like passive range of motion, flexion, and extension, which is what's happening in the top photo here. Just having warmed up the muscles, we're just flexing this joint and then extending it again. And then we've got different types of massage. Massage can be effleurage, which is just sort of stroking in varying degrees of how hard into the muscle you put the pressure, or petrissage, which is what we're doing here, which is kneading the muscles. And all of this will improve circulation, it will decrease pain and swelling, and increase joint mobility. And there's a wide range of physiotherapy aids that are available for veterinary patients. Most of them come from the human world. So we've got the inflatable supports, this thing in the top here, sort of bone-shaped, that you can inflate little or a lot for different size animals, depending on how mobile they are. And then we've got gym balls of varying sizes, the same as they're used for people. TheraBands, this is a TheraBand. A TheraBand provides resistance, so it's an elasticated band. And then down here we've got a wobble cushion or a balance cushion, which again is inflatable, so you can put a little bit of air in, or quite a lot of air, and the animal stands on this, and this is useful for strengthening muscles. And hydrotherapy is used because water provides increased resistance. So we've got warm water is very good That decreases muscle tension and it decreases pain. And it's used for many conditions, including the neurological and degenerative diseases. And water is also good for weight loss. And we need to make sure our patients, which are overweight, lose weight because that will help with analgesia as well. Traditional acupuncture, dry needling and electroacupuncture all use the same needles, and that's these very fine needles here. These are called filiform needles. So for dry needling, which is slightly different from traditional acupuncture, needles are placed at what's called trigger points, and these are areas of damage in muscles, and the aim is to disperse the trigger points. And this is good for chronic pain because there's muscle relaxation. And wound healing is stimulated because of the increased blood flow. And the chronic pain of this Irish setter in the photo here was managed very well with a combination of acupuncture and memantine, which is a drug that's very similar to amantadine. So it's an NMDA antagonist drug. And these are all forms of electrostimulation. So TENS is transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, and NMES is neuromuscular electrical stimulation. The TENS target sensory nerves to suppress pain signals from being sent to the brain and to aid in the release of endorphins. And NMES targets muscle via motor nerves to cause muscle contraction. Very often you can use the same machine, it just uses a different wavelength from 10, so you just switch the selector on your machine. And electroacupuncture is when electrical impulses pass from one needle to another, and the current stimulates a larger area than a single needle. And the changes in cells and tissues lead to decreased pain and increase muscle strength. And this is very good for musculoskeletal disease and neurological pain. LLLT is low-level laser therapy, bit of a tongue twister. It's also called photobiomodulation, which is not that much easier to say. So what happens here is light interacts with cells, endorphins are released, and this leads to decreased pain and inflammation and increased tissue healing. Laser also affects joint fluid and cartilage, so it's good for osteoarthritis. And some practices I know use laser therapy following routine surgeries as an added means of healing and analgesia. So sometimes it's an optional extra when you have your cat spade or your bitch spade. And then we've got regenerative stem cell therapy or platelet-rich plasma therapy. So for the regenerative stem cell therapy, bone marrow or fat are extracted under anaesthesia. So it's an invasive technique because you need to give a general anaesthetic. So bone marrow we usually take from the humerus, and fat is taken from the adipose tissue in the abdomen. You just need a small incision. And then you send your sample off to the laboratory, and it's usually back the next day. And stem cells are then injected back into the patient, either via the intra-articular, intravenous, or you can use the subcutaneous route. And it's beneficial for osteoarthritis, hip dysplasia, cruciate rupture, and tendon and ligament damage. It's also many other things: kidney disease in cats, inflammatory bowel disease in people, dry eye, and autoimmune disease, and lots of others. Platelet-rich plasma therapy is made from the patient's own blood, so it's non-invasive. You don't need anaesthesia, you just need to take a blood sample. Send it away, the platelets are separated and they're concentrated in the plasma. And this is useful because they contain growth factors. And it's given by intravenous or intra-articular injection. And again, it's good for osteoarthritis, tendon, and ligament damage. Nutraceuticals include the cartilage modifiers and the supplements. So you'll have heard of all of these. We've got things, these are things that are used for people as well. We've got the omega-3 fatty acids, glucosamine, chondroitin, greenlit muscle. However, there are no proven beneficial effects, and it is controversial as to whether they help or not. In people people and animals, and studies have been done for both species, and there's nothing to prove that they do work, and there's nothing to prove that they don't work. And then other treatments, we've got weight loss for obese patients that will help with joint disease and general mobility, as well as well-being and morale. Adipose tissue is actually seen as the body's largest endocrine organ because it secretes chemicals which are involved with endocrine function. So we've got things like adipokines, steroid hormones, and hormones that are concerned with appetite, such as leptin and reproduction. And actually, leptin is also concerned with reproduction. It also secretes cytokines. Some of them are good, such as the interleukins for cell growth and the immune response. And some of them are bad, such as tumor necrosis factor and the pro-inflammatory cytokines. If applied correctly, support dressings or dressings can help with analgesia. So we've got a couple of dogs here that are very comfortable. The Bull Terrier on the left, he was quite sore, and he wasn't due to have a second support dressing. He'd had one initially, and we popped another support dressing on, and he did actually calm down and went to sleep. And the dog on the left, again, it's not easy to keep these dressings on when you need to go quite high up, but again, this one did help, and this dog is quite comfortable. And there are other things that you can do to try and prevent pain. So we've got careful positioning and handling of the anaesthetized patient, because if you're a bit rough with them, or if you don't take those extra added measures such as padding the joints and the limbs and any bony prominences when they're anaesthetized, then that discomfort that's incurred under anaesthesia can manifest as pain when the animal wakes up and in the post-anaesthetic period. So we need to be very careful when animals are anaesthetized as well. Okay, so to finish off with, I'm just going to go through a little case study. So this is a dog which came in actually only a few days ago. So this is a bit of a lastminute.com inclusion into the webinar. So this is supposed to be a French bulldog cross. It didn't really look much like a French bulldog, but that's what the owners thought he was. So a male crossbreed, really puppy, 5 months of age, weighing 14 kilos. And this little chap came in after a road traffic accident, and he had a tibial avulsion and a stifle fracture. So it's quite nasty, especially as he's obviously young. So surgery was planned for fracture repair, and on the morning of his surgery, he was quite unhappy. He was quite depressed, despite the analgesia. His temperature and blood pressure were slightly low. Blood work, which the owners had opted for, was all within normal limits. So he was assigned an ASA grade of 2. So I'm just going to put some pictures here, and I just want you to think, for pre-medication, which of these are suitable and which of these aren't suitable, or which of these, if you were maybe given the task of creating an analgesic, a pre-medication plan for this patient, which would then be agreed or not by your veterinary surgeon, which one of these would you choose? So going from the left, we've got acepromazine. We've got dexdomitor, so dexdomitor or domitor for the sake of this webinar, one and the same thing. Methadone, buprenorphine, torbogesic, butorphanol. So which of these do you think we could use, and which would we not use? So acepromazine, I'm going to say no for several reasons. The dog didn't need sedating because he was depressed, so we don't need that level of sedation. Acepromazine's got a long duration of action. It's up to about 8 hours, 6 to 8 hours. And if you give your acepromazine and you don't like what it does, there's no reversal agent. We can't antagonize it. You have to wait for it to wear off. So 8 hours would be a long time to wait. Also, if you think of what acepromazine does physiologically, it causes vasodilation, so it lowers the temperature and lowers the blood pressure. And this dog already had a low temperature and a slightly low blood pressure. So that's a no-no for acepromazine. An alpha 2 agonist agent, sorry, Domitor or Dexdomitor, yeah, could have had some. They're good in very small doses for pain relief. So not necessarily that we're going to rule it out. He was quite depressed and doesn't actually need sedating. Methadone, pure opioid agonist, that's going to give us the best analgesia. So methadone, we're going to say yes. Buprenorphine, a partial opioid agonist, it's only really good for moderate pain. This is not going to provide the analgesia that a dog with a broken leg needs. And butorphanol, no, should not really even be considering that. Butorphanol is good if you need to sedate a patient for x-rays or something, or if your animal's got a cough, but not as far as pain relief goes. So this dog actually just had methadone in his pre-meds, but had he been anxious or stressed and needed a bit of sedation, then dexmedetomidine or medetomidine would have been fine as a very small dose. And then what can we do intraoperatively? So I've got here epidural on the left or nerve block. So could we do an epidural? Could we do a nerve block? Yes, we could do either because it's a stifle. So he could have had either. This dog actually had femoral and sciatic nerve blocks to provide the necessary analgesia. We could easily have done an epidural as well. Sometimes the orthopedic surgeons don't like doing an epidural if there's lots of implants, just in case the dog's wobbly when it gets up because of lack of sensation and maybe damages. But however, it would never preclude analgesia by epidural if that was the only option. But for this dog, it did have hind limb nerve blocks. And then again, intraoperatively, these are things that you could do. Would you go for a fentanyl CRI on the left here? This is fentanyl CRI. Go for a ketamine CRI. Or would we go for methadone top up? So, yes, we could have done any of these. If you don't have the facility and the equipment to do CRI, then you're going to need to do your methadone top up every 4 hours or so intraoperatively. So if you're still there 4 hours after you've given the first dose of methadone, then yes, you need to top it up. So our puppy actually had a fentanyl and a ketamine CRI, so two separate syringe drivers, then each one can be controlled separately. And then post-operatively, these are things we could do. Are we going to bolus buprenorphine in the immediate post-operative period? No, because he still needs methadone. So we're going to bolus the methadone according to pain assessment and pain scale. We can continue the CRIs. Generally, we would tend to tail off the fentanyl CRI because it does leave them quite depressed and it can affect their respiratory function. But you can get it down really, really low in the post-operative period and then stop it. And again, ketamine can be continued and reduced. So we can reduce the dose of ketamine until eventually we can stop it. So generally, yes, keep these CRIs going for a little while and then stop them. Dressing, yes, we tend to put a dressing. This is completely dependent on your orthopedic surgeon or your veterinary surgeon's instructions. Some surgeons like to put a dressing on for 12 to 24 hours, and some don't. Generally, we will have a dressing for 12 to 24 hours, and then take the dressing off. Other things that we can do. We've got benefits of feeding. Also, we need to think about feeding increases the blood glucose levels, which might be decreased under anaesthesia. It will warm your patient up because of the energy. It will improve their well-being and it will satisfy their hunger and it will make them feel better. And if they feel better, if they're not in pain, then they're going to eat. So that's good. This is a young dog. Remember, this dog is out raring to go out for his walk and he was hungry. So he's actually quite difficult to manage post-operatively because he was a baby. He was 20 weeks old, and his pain was managed really well. So yeah, you need to obviously think of other things like short lead walks according to veterinary surgeons' instructions. Obviously, he's not let off his harness, and it's controlled and timed. So back to another dog now. As I said earlier, don't forget TLC because this can help with pain management. This is a little dog that had a septic abdomen, and he was still painful and sad after his surgery. You can see it's a little sort of Staffy type Bull Terrier, so usually quite stoic, but he looks very sad. Just looking at him, he's leaning, sitting on his vet bed, he's leaning into the wall, his eyes are closed, his ears are back, he really doesn't look very happy at all. But after analgesia, here he is finally sleeping. So you can see that it's two different people. You can tell because they've got different socks and different colour scrubs. So there's a nurse on the left, sat with him initially, and he just put himself upside down on her and went to sleep. We needed her back on the shop floor, so she had to go back and do some work. So they man she and another person who's a ward assistant managed to effect a sort of takeover, and they changed positions in the kennel and without waking the dog up, so he was still sleeping. So don't forget the animal human bond is mutually beneficial. We have pet animals, pets as therapy animals. They have a positive effect on pain levels and morale in people. So there's no reason to think that it doesn't work the other way around. And we have chemicals which are released by the brain, such as oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, and of course, all the endorphins, those feel-good factors, and they all create an analgesic effect. And this decreases heart rate, blood pressure, and also stressors, those stressor hormones. And we see this in animals when their owners leave a piece of clothing, so it's got their scent on it, or a toy or something, or even when they're just given attention and direct contact. Remember, these are domestic pets. They like to be spoken to and stroked. So we need to spend time with our patients, and this also will help relieve their stress and their pain. That's it for the webinar. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.